Hello, everyone. Glad to be with you for this virtual component of the IAMCR 2023. My name is Dr. Lisa Bruton, and I am an associate professor at Southern Illinois University in the College of Arts and Media and the School of Media Arts. And I'm presenting today a paper entitled Not Much Left to Lose: Resisting Repression in Thailand, Myanmar, and the Philippines. So what I'm doing today is introducing you to what is very much a work in progress. It's a smaller component and kind of a new direction for me as part of a larger project. Today I'm looking at I'm looking in the larger project at the various ways in which people resist authoritarianism in different contexts and how these resistance strategies across different contexts, different countries, and different parts of the world share some key characteristics. And what I'm looking at today is the centrality of affect, precarity, and trauma specifically, which affects not only the work of activists and advocates and so on, but also professional journalists, artists, and other media makers in authoritarian contexts. So I'm really interested in the ways in which journalists navigate these dangers and opportunities in their work in these contexts. So we have a situation where autocracy and authoritarianism are well theorized. We understand a lot about them. We have lots of discussions about different kinds of authoritarianism, but those who resist authoritarianism, their practices and strategies are less satisfactorily theorized, especially with respect to those who are consider themselves professionals, such as journalists working, for example, with independent, non-state, or non-affiliated media outlets. So I'm in the process right now of really starting to compare to theorize comparatively across several contexts, thinking about these the experiences of these folks. So while the bigger project, and even in the paper, I talk about several different situations, relevant situations, I really focus on two case studies in this paper. The focus on two photojournalists in the Philippines who document the victims of the drug war instigated by the former president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, and of a journalist in Thailand whose work for the alternative news outlet Pratchatai brought her into close contact with violent death. So I'm really interested in understanding how they navigate these situations, and how they do this in order to carry out what they feel is a necessary obligation that results from what they found as part of this work. Let's start with, first of all, the situation, the context, and the authoritarians that these folks are resisting. So we have a sort of a new phase of dictatorship, kind of that followed the earlier wave of democratic reforms that swept through Southeast Asia and other parts of the world in the 80s and 90s. So this is a kind of a post-democratic wave return to dictatorship. But this, in this case, spin dictators or informational autocrats, drawing from the work of Gurdjieff and Treisman, share some characteristics. They're generally less bloody and ideological than the overt repression propaganda of the past. They tend to subvert democracy while also they subvert democratic institutions while also they mimic the strategies and practices of democracies. And they also manipulate and control information to convince the public that they're competent and acting in the public interest. So I'm introducing you today to two folks, Duterte, who continues to carry out some of these same characteristics. Yeah, like employing a rhetoric of economic performance and provision of public services. Duterte and these other spin dictators also target opponents. This might sound familiar, accusing them of fabricating crimes like fake news or journalists becoming enemies of the people or dissidents as drug dealers or communists. And yet they're often very, very popular, accepted as necessary by many in the general population. So I'm going to introduce you to two. This is General Prayut Chan-o-cha of Thailand, who, as many of these dictators do, have a very adversarial relationship with the press. Like here, he's presenting a cardboard cutout of himself instead of a press conference, and spraying journalists whose questions he doesn't like as they're challenging his COVID response. I'm also going to introduce you to Rodrigo Duterte, who's also adversarial with the press and is infamous, one of many things he's said. But just because you're a journalist, you're not exempted from assassination if you're a son of a bitch. For now, I'm going to leave off a discussion of Myanmar because after the coup of 2021, it's really a situation where it has reverted to the sort of traditional fear dictatorship that doesn't fit this strategy as much, the new spin dictators, and also for time limits. Okay, so I want to look basically at different ways that people are fighting and resisting autocrats in these situations. And, much of the larger work is also looking at very creative strategies, specifically fighting through content and culture, like using memes and hashtags, cartoons, music, popular culture, and protests, and so on. I won't go through all of these for time limitations, although I'm happy to answer any questions if you're interested. This is another example from Thailand in 2020 when the student protests took on Harry Potter themes in order to kind of challenge the monarchy using he who cannot be named as a sit-in for the king, and kind of making a comment on the lèse majeste law in Thailand. Okay, so in theorizing this, I'm looking at sort of literature on resistance because even though these journalists definitely define themselves as professional, they also take on different kinds of roles. They're definitely, this is not a he said, she said situation when you people that, the people of a country are being attacked or a marginalized population is being attacked. So even though these journalists define themselves as professional, they're also carrying out something that I've kind of called professional precarious creative labor. And also thinking about trauma and affect, much of the research already looks at focuses on the global north and also one-off events that have affected journalists in the global north rather than, so for example, 9/11 and other events where journalists in the global north have been members of communities that have been in crisis or disaster or under attack. And this really doesn't address the experiences of the many, many journalists who live and work in vice violence or crisis afflicted communities in other parts of the world. Okay, I'm not going to go through all the frameworks that I use, but I'm in trying to analyze and theorize the work of these journalists and that I'm working with. I'm thinking about precarity, for example, calls to de-Westernize creative labor studies, thinking about collective action, connective action, and also thinking about the ways in which these journalists are kind of organically, along with the communities that they're part of, kind of emerging with a new kind of civil skill that reconceptualizes different forms of solidarity and community. And all of these things really have to be considered with respect as well to trauma and precarity that really influence the situation greatly. So, what kind of situations do we have in such contexts as this? I'm going to give you a brief landscape overview of these two countries. In both countries, we have politically polarized media, more so in Thailand. In the Philippines, there's a lot of support for Duterte and now Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who was just recently elected. Thailand has a more polarized media situation, but both of the countries do have polarized and politicized media outlets. Political economy of the media in both countries involve low pay for journalists, which makes them, of course, vulnerable to bribery and so on. And commercial landscape, which makes sustainability difficult. There is some of what of a public broadcasting commitment in Thailand, but not a lot of access for normal folks to that to the Thailand public broadcasting system. But at least there's some conception of public service there. In terms of control, the Philippines has been consistently a very violent place to be a journalist. The assassinations of journalists is very high. And red tagging of journalists and other activists means they're regularly targeted, including rhetorically by government officials, which of course leaves them open then for further attack. Okay, and control of dissent in Thailand is a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, less overt. There's manipulation of advertising, the use of laws, basically lèse majeste, defamation, and other laws. There are forced disappearances, but they are much more rare, and they're definitely not advertised the way that they are in the Philippines with Duterte and his pride in his drug war. Okay, so I want to talk about what happens in situations like this. And I want to begin with the Philippines. In December of 2018, the bodies of two men washed up on the shore of Thailand's Mekong River, their disemboweled stomachs stuffed with concrete blocks. The three had, or these two, were assistants of another activist called Surachai. And the three had gone missing in December, earlier in December, about 2 weeks earlier. Surachai in the center, his whereabouts remain unknown, but these three had fled to Laos after the 2014 coup in fear that the Thailand's military junta would rearrest them for lèse majeste, which they had already served prison terms for, although the king had pardoned them. Although these graphic deaths were very sensational, they didn't get much coverage in Thailand's mainstream commercial media, but the small media outlet of Prachatai had a very different response, including from the journalist Netawan, who had interviewed many of these, who had interviewed, knew all of these folks. He knew these activists and also others that had also disappeared. So when she learned about how these two had died, and the fact that Surachai's body was also no longer was not available, but he had most likely died. She had nightmares about this for months. And around this time, she also heard that three other activists who she had followed, who were also in exile, had been arrested in Vietnam and turned over to the Thai authorities, and their whereabouts were unknown. For this reason, she decided to write about one of them, Uncle Sanam Luang, who is an activist, and she wrote about him in Prachatai. Prachatai is really one of the most important independent sources of information about the efforts of groups and individuals struggling for justice, freedom of information in Thailand. So Uncle Sanam Luang was one of the prisoners who had fled, and he basically had disappeared along with them. So in this situation, Netiwan was extremely troubled. Her trauma had been multiple. First of all, she had been traumatized by her experience as a vicarious witness, getting to know these folks and trying to explain, humanize them, make them real for people. But also then, as the result of her work itself, she became a target, in the sense that she had to be very careful about how she published this information. She had to use a pen name. She had to be very careful about her own security and so on. I want to give more information about the second case study, the Night Watchers, unfortunately sometimes dubbed also the Night Crawlers. These are journalists whose work is very traumatic. They work at night and they go around and they document the violent drug war of Rodrigo Duterte, which is continuing somewhat as morphing a bit, but under the recent election of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. But like Netiwan's work, the work of these journalists involves immersion in a community to tell their story. So it's a kind of ethnographic journalism. And this work really, these folks literally chase bodies. They go out at night. This is when the drug killings happen. They chase these bodies often to make sure that they can take photos and get evidence in cases where the police are trying to remove the bodies quickly from the site. But they also interview and talk to and photograph family members, police who are removing the corpses, the onlookers, those workers charged with disposing of the bodies, but most of all, the family members. We can see here, victims are often gruesomely packaged, wrapped up in packaging tape and so on, marked with signs that say things like, "I'm a pusher, do not emulate me." And the families, night after night, the families discovering the bodies of their loved ones. And this, as you can imagine, is extremely traumatic. And yet they continue to do this work. One of the things that happens, though, at this point is that they realize that this is really not just a drug war. There is involvement in high by higher levels. This is not, as the police often say, most of the victims are not. They're not fighting back or resisting. Many of them have had their hands tied behind their backs. And so at this point, these journalists are kind of collecting evidence. Documentation is really kind of what's happening here. I don't have a lot of time left, so I'm going to kind of wrap up here by sort of saying that really one of the ways, a clear way in which these journalists work to try to challenge the strategies of the information autocrats and spin dictators is to really fight the dehumanization of the other, and to what I think is maybe we could call a new civil contract of journalism, which borrows from Azoulay's term, the civil contract of photography, when she argues that audiences possess a certain power to suspend the gesture of sovereign power, which seeks to totally dominate the relationships between them. So as we look at these things and as these things are published, these images, these media, messages, they should work to fight the dehumanizing discourse of autocrats, and in particular, noticing how these folks identify victims by their names and detail their lives as much as possible in this coverage to represent addicts and extrajudicial victims with dignity, to reframe coverage from a punitive addict, like addict is evil framing, like a framework that sees a punitive response as the best rather than. And frame it instead to a more healthcare-centered framing, a more addiction treatment framing, and of course, focus on the successes of community-based recovery programs. So, really, by resisting the dehumanizing discourse and modeling better communities, both by looking at local communities and how they're responding, and also working in local, independent, small-scale media. Which is where many of the really important investigative reports are coming from. This is really how these folks work to what I argue is sort of an emergence of a civil contract of media that sort of mimics a civil contract of care that we also see sort of emerging out of these contexts. Okay, I'm sure that there are many questions, and my paper is a work in progress, so it doesn't hold together yet, but I do look forward to hearing any kind of responses and feedback from you. And I thank you very much for your attention.